Back with you once again to kick off a brand new month on Tuesday, June 1st, 2021 on Connecticut Today. One of our go-to guys on all things political, Dr. Gary Rose from Sacred Heart University in Fairfield, shared a few minutes with us in the 4 o'clock hour regarding a new book that he's authored, looking at how all of Connecticut's different cities and towns govern themselves. Republican State Rep. Craig Fishbein, representing parts of Wallingford and Cheshire, joined us in the 5 o'clock hour to summarize what's in a reworked version of a so-called clean slate bill. Our buddy Dr. Gary Rose, who chairs the government department at Sacred Heart University in Fairfield, is back with us. New book out by Gary, and it's called New England Local Government, The Case of Connecticut. Gary, hi, it's Paul again. How are you, sir?
Good, Paul. How are you?
Not too bad. Good to hear from you again. And why didn't you title this The Case of 169 Little Fiefdoms? Because isn't that, Gary, the criticism we always hear? Oh, my God, these little towns and cities, everybody thinks they can do it their way. I guess you didn't want to do that, did you?
No, I know. A small state with 169 towns.
Wow.
I know. It's like 169 little nations all, you know, under... within one border. And so it really is quite remarkable, this little state that we have here.
So whenever I have an author on, Gary, local like yourself or national, I always have to ask the origins of this, and how long does it take to produce a book like this?
Well, you know, this was a small book, and you know, a little over 100 pages, and it took me 2 years. It could have been maybe a little speedier, but you know, I have teaching obligations, administrative obligations, mm-hmm. and so in the type of work I do and my obligations when I write a book, it really is in between a lot of the other duties. And so
sure.
this one took 2 years to do. Normally it takes a little longer, but 2 years was probably about what this manuscript took to complete.
So the subtitle is The Case of Connecticut. What is, Gary Rose, if you could summarize it before we get to the minutia, can that be summarized as no?
It's really creativity, and that's something that I really wanted to do. I wanted to get into the towns this time. The last book I wrote was based on the 2018 gubernatorial mm-hmm. contest and the issues facing the state. This time I went down into the real grassroots to take a look at how towns were governing themselves and how creative the towns were. And the one thing I must say about Connecticut, you know, we do have a lot of these little towns, and we have cities, of course, but it's amazing, though, how vibrant and creative they are when it comes to, problem solving and policy innovation. And that's something that I think we really should all be very proud of, is the fact that our communities, they are subdivisions of the state. You know, they don't have, constitutional status, but they do have... home rule. They can govern themselves, but yet it's still under the jurisdiction of the state's constitution. It's amazing, though, with home rule, just how creative these towns are.
So generally, Gary Rose, from the top down on the pyramid here, let's say the leader on top down, a lot of these smaller communities, and I always wonder when I take my Sunday or weekend drives going through these smaller towns, am I to assume that a lot of these smaller areas, Gary, start with a mayor or a first selectman or first select woman, and then work down from there to, say, an RTM or a town council, stuff like that?
Well, a lot of different models exist out there, but you do find, you know, board of selectmen, town meeting combinations. There's a lot of them in Connecticut. Unfortunately, the town meetings are not well attended. You know, they're actually very low turnout in a lot of those meetings, but they do make decisions. You know, when you get into the more urban communities, that's where you find the mayor council form of government, pretty common, although some small towns have mayors too. And then, you know, we also have a good number of, real middle-class towns in Connecticut that function under they have a town council, but they also have a, what's called a town manager. And, of course, that's really more the administrative model of running communities. So you have these different models out there. And you do mention the RTM, like Fairfield has it. And some RTMs are really, you know, representative town meetings, very large, like 50 people, 100 people.
So how does that work, Gary, the RTM, say, people hear that and they say, well, how is that different from, say, a town council or a board of alders or board of selectmen? It really is fascinating. I would imagine the RTMs, Gary, a lot of them or the model like that may stem from colonial days.
I'm not sure how far back it goes. That's a very good question. But it really is, a lot of it has to do with the size of that and the community's commitment to having more people involved. And, you know, some towns say, okay, an elected town council is sufficient for making decisions, but the RTMs are very large. And I think a lot of it you know, it's interesting that you ask how far back it goes. I really didn't look into that, how far back RTMs go, but it is in communities that believe that citizens should have as much input as possible. And so they have these very large RTMs working with, the first selectmen and the board of selectmen and so forth. So it's very interesting. Yeah.
And I would imagine, too, Gary, whether it's from big cities all the way down to, you know, these small towns and these boroughs, money and how it's spent is usually the main function of all these groups.
Oh, yeah. Oh, gosh. That's really an amazing thing, too, is, you know, the budget issues. And, you know, in the book I quote Harold Laswell's classic work called, you know, Who Gets What, When, and How, you know, and that's really the definition of politics, really. And what we have going on in each little community and in the cities, too, it's fascinating to see how they make those decisions, because that's really where the politics comes into play. And one would be very naive to conclude, too, that it doesn't make much difference which party is in power as far as how much, you know, the spending priorities and how the money is raised, too. And that's another thing I certainly did discover, too, is there's a great deal of, you know, partisan influence in even making very simple decisions about how much you want to spend on education and so forth. So, yeah, it's really the parties that are in power that really determine those key issues. Absolutely,
there are a lot of people, Gary, who talk to, you know, they express a lot of chagrin that these individual little fiefdoms, as they say, slow things down. Connecticut could be, you know, actually they say, well, we have counties, but let's go back to when those county lines meant something. I would imagine that in some of these areas you've researched, that idea probably wouldn't go over too well.
It wouldn't. You know, we're one of two states in the entire country that does not function under county government. It's us and Rhode Island. And we did experiment for a while with county government, and it didn't work because the towns in Connecticut are really old. You know, they go way back. And there is so much tradition, and people are so proud of their local communities.
Yeah.
They did not want to function under county commissioners and so forth. They wanted to have their own government with their own, you know, and their own decision-making structures. And so the whole experiment with county government was a tremendous failure here in the state. And it shows just how much pride, I guess you might say, people have in their local communities, because they don't. They love their home rule. They love, you know, governing themselves. And not, it really comes right down to Connecticut, even though we're in southern New England, you know, it still really reflects that traditional grassroots New England style of government in Connecticut.
And I'm often reminded of that, Gary, when I do my post-show walk. I'll go home tonight when I'm, you know, walking in Wallingford, and we've had the same mayor there for about 130 years now. Just kidding, Mayor. Love you. There are actually, Gary Rose, there are on the streets in the center of Wallingford, which is, you know, a pretty big-sized town now. We still have hitching posts there in the center of town. I can send you, and they don't touch them. There, Gary Rose, there are hitching posts in the center of Wallingford. What does that tell you?
I know, it just tells you how much pride people have and how much tradition and history there is in each community. You know, they talk about Connecticut's history, but I think what the real the unknown story is the history in each town and how each town and city too, you know, how they were formed, where they came from, and who the key people were. And you're right. It's just the Connecticut is a very, very historic place within the context of our democracy in this country. And so it's a fascinating place to really study and to live.
And if you want to come to Wallingford, let me know. I'll make sure your steed can be hitched anywhere it wants to. There you go. Gary Rose, right. Dr. Gary Rose, head of the government department at Sacred Heart University in Fairfield. New England Local Government, The Case of Connecticut. Check it out on Amazon, hardcover and all that. Gary, be good, and we'll talk down the road. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks, Paul.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye. Right. Folks, I'm not kidding you. Gary, thanks. Appreciate it. We have hitching posts still around in Wallingford. Checking in to the state capitol, what's going on up there? Particularly, I'm wondering, with this clean slate bill, which was kind of ping-ponging last week when last we spoke between both chambers. The ranking Republican on the legislature's Judiciary Committee is with us again. Wallingford, Cheshire State Rep. Craig Fishbein is with us. Craig, how are you, sir?
Good. How are you doing, Paul? Nice to speak to you again.
Craig, it's always a pleasure to speak to you. How was your weekend, by the way? A little vacay? Did it work out okay?
Yes, sir. I ran about 8 miles on the beach in Texas. So.
Well, I was running with you.
You had some rain.
I was running with you in spirit. How's that? So I'm doing my mental running.
I heard it was cold and rainy up here.
Oh, it wasn't real good. No, I was actually walking in Midtown Manhattan, feeling like it was November after seeing my kid. But glad you had a nice weekend. So listen, you're back to some of the lunacy going on there at the Capitol. Craig, what is the status now of this clean slate bill, which got out of the upper chamber, the Senate, several days ago, but it met some resistance in the House? What's going on?
Yeah, it actually passed the House last Thursday. We debated the bill for a lot longer than we originally thought. We went about approximately 8 hours, and we ran a lot of amendments. You know, I don't think a lot of people know what's in this bill. A lot of the people that voted for it, you know, I pointed out that they're automatically erasing many hate crimes, which, you know, it's amazing, all the things we talk about, you know, race going on in this country. Mm-hmm. And there are Class D felonies that are hate crimes that the Democrats voted to automatically erase off of people's records. And also, interestingly, I don't think they realize this also, they allow for the erasure of a felony quicker than a misdemeanor. And let me just explain. The erasure of a misdemeanor is 7 years after a conviction, and the erasure of a felony is 10 years after conviction. But the maximum penalty on a Class D felony is 5 years. Okay, so maximum on a misdemeanor is 1 year. So a person could serve 1 year on a misdemeanor. This is going to automatically get erased off of their record 6 years later. Whereas the felony, if they serve the maximum term of 5 years, it would be erased 5 years after they get out. Does that make any logical sense at all?
You know, you just said, Craig, that Democrats voted for this, or some of your friends on the other side of the aisle, they voted for this without maybe really knowing the intricacies of this. Here's a question I always have. Could it be that, Craig, or is it that there's a reluctance, maybe, and I'm not asking you to tell me how other people are thinking, but is there a reluctance sometimes, Craig, on a bill like this for those in the majority party to buck their leadership? I mean, how can you not know in good conscience, no matter what side of the aisle you're on, Craig, about what's actually in a bill?
Well, the one way is a lot of these bills have many pages. They're written in such a fashion, you know, lawyers learn how to interpret the written statute. That's not a skill that everyone has. Mm. So, but when, you know, I get up on the House floor and I point out to the speaker, you're erasing hate crimes, and then I run an amendment that says, let's take these, let's exempt these hate crimes from this automatic erasure, because I think it's abhorrent if somebody gets convicted of, you know, burning a cross on someone's lawn. Okay, I'm not going to automatically erase that off of somebody's record, right? Because we have a Board of Pardons and Paroles. And with particularity to that amendment, I went to one of the advocates on racial relations up here who happens to be African-American after they voted against my amendment. And I said, what are you doing? Like after the vote had closed. And he said, I didn't know. It was just a Republican amendment. I voted against.
Oh, come on. Are you serious?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And here I am, you know, and I ran amendments to exempt crimes against women, you know, a violation of a criminal protective order, which, you know, when somebody gets arrested for a domestic violence crime, the court issues a criminal protective order against that person. You know, don't stalk, harass, threaten, assault, that kind of stuff. Well, when somebody violates that order, they are convicted of criminal protection, criminal violation of a protective order. Right. So many of those stem from a domestic violence case, but they're not domestic violence crimes. Those are automatically being erased. So those in the legislature that say they're advocates for domestic violence victims, you know, obviously you're not if you're voting to erase these things off of people's criminal records.
What is the, and Craig, I know it may be tough to get in the head of some of the folks on the other side of the aisle here, but okay, a lot of us, we can all agree on, as you said previously, and when we talked about this, a lot, if not all, misdemeanors, and maybe a few felonies, but I always revert back to, Craig, at least in my mind, I'm sure you may too, the question pops in, what are they thinking? Okay, you want to get rid of some felonies, that's fine, but I would be asking the same thing you are. Are you really understanding what this is, or is this just a case, Craig, of three or four people in leadership saying, hey, this is the way it's going to be, or we're going to have problems here?
Yeah, I think that's unfortunately an aspect of this. You know, the committee process itself is sort of glad-handing each other. You know, if you don't support my bill, then your bill is not going to run in my committee, so on and so forth. It's a big circle. So a lot of that goes on, unfortunately, up here. You know, today we debated a bill having to do with racial relations. And in there it said that zoning, there was to be a study of zoning and the impact upon racial segregation, that kind of stuff. But this is a bill that came out of the Public Health Committee.
Yeah.
It should have gone to the Planning and Development Committee. And I stood up and said, I believe in the committee process. And if somebody has to ramrod this concept through a committee that has absolutely nothing to do with zoning, then obviously it's a bad bill. And that's not the process, you know, that we should be having. I say many times, if the public only knew what happened in Hartford, they'd be appalled.
Oh, I used to hear that. We all remember our buddy Larry Caffaro, who was up there for years. Mm. And Larry always used to say the same thing from Norwalk. He would say, Craig, exactly what you just said. If the public only knew what goes on that we try to do, you know, to make sense of behind the scenes. Finally, Craig, before we let you go, everything I'm reading in the Current today and the News Junkie or on the CT Mirror, the budget process here, it sounds like the majority Democrats may be bucking the governor a little or not. What's up with that?
I have not heard anything, you know, news on that front.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I get from the media.
Yeah, because people don't realize, I have to tell them, right? The Republicans, I mean, unfortunately, you guys and gals are not in on the process for the budget, right?
Yeah, we are expressly excluded. You know, they have the votes, and basically they tell us this is what we're going to run.
Yeah.
The big mystery is the implementer, usually.
Mm. Craig, I have a gentleman calling here. Hold on just a second. He wants to ask you a quick question here regarding the erasure of penalties over time. Craig, hang on. We'll get to this question. What is your question, sir?
Good afternoon, gentlemen. My question being, I understand they want to erase some of these hate crime penalties or whatever you want to call them.
Yeah.
Criteria do they utilize? Do they think of the victims in these crimes that obviously have got them now, a lifelong trauma?
Yeah.
That, you know, how does that work? How do you explain to the victim, oh, this guy can now get a job, his records erased, he's now to be allowed to be a productive member of society,
mm-hmm.
but he's already violated somebody else's civil liberties when he committed that hate crime. How do you explain it to them when you erase these penalties from these people's backgrounds?
Great question. Caller, thank you. Craig is back with us, despite my bad thumbs here. Craig, I don't know whether you heard, but the gentleman said, how is this squared with some victims of these crimes? Assault, hate crimes, things like that.
Oh, exactly. That was one of the points that I brought up. Now, we did put in an amendment which, in the future, if crimes are going to be erased, that a victim can get notification, but approximately 300,000 people are going to, their records are going to be erased, and there is no procedure to inform those victims, and that's a tragedy in and of itself.
Craig, thank you. Keep us up to date with it, and you guys and gals on the GOP side, keep banging the pots and pans on this, because now that this thing is passed, people need to know what the deal is. Craig, thank you. Appreciate it, my friend. We'll talk down the road. Thanks. All right, Craig Fischbein, there you go. Wallingford, Cheshire, GOP state rep. So,